we have two exceptional speakers and individuals and human beings that are going to talk to you about navigating both of these worlds. The first is our very own Dr. David Pelkovitz. Dr. Pelkovitz holds the Gwendolyn and Joseph Strauss Chair in Psychology and Jewish Education at Yeshiva University's Azrieli Graduate School of Jewish Education and Administration, where he is also the Special Assistant to the President. Serving for over two decades as Director of Psychology at North Shore University Hospital, NYU School of Medicine, and Clinical Professor of Psychology and Psychiatry at NYU School of Medicine. He has consulted extensively with the Jewish communities of the United States, Europe, and Israel on a wide range of issues facing children and adolescents. Before I turn the mic over to Dr. Pelkovitz, I'd like to give a special thanks to Gabi Weinberg of SOY, JSC, and all the other wonderful organizations that have helped plan this evening. And without further ado, Dr. David Pelkovitz.
Apologies, I broke my arm, it's so hard for me to stand, so I'll speak sitting down. So I hope you all see me, right? We're good? Okay. So we've been discussing how to handle this, so I think what we're going to do is I'm going to speak for about 20 minutes, and then followed by illustrious keynote speakers, so to speak, for however long he wants. And then we'll go to the discussion, which hopefully will help us focus on this. Interesting.
Lately, there's been a crisis of leadership in the from community. And I think it's a crisis. I think that I've been hearing more and more about shuls that have a hard time getting presidents to take over, people who have a hard time getting replacements for board members, a decline in people willing to volunteer. That's true, there are many people who get meaning from leadership, and I'm going to talk about the pros and the cons. But let me start with the basic premise that I have a feeling we're both going to have, and that's that I think almost anybody I've ever heard speak about this, who talks about this from the standpoint of experience, will argue that when you have to choose between your leadership responsibilities and your family responsibilities, family always has to come first. It doesn't mean you can't find balance, doesn't mean you can't be incredibly valuable as a leader in the community, but it's hard for me to imagine anybody being an effective leader if they don't figure out a way to steal time for their family as a priority. You know, there was the Rosh Yeshiva of Tells before Rav Gifter was Rav Bloch. And I once heard this from his son's best friend. His son's best friend told me that Rav Bloch, who was extremely, extremely busy, was starting the Yeshiva of Tells in Cleveland, world-renowned yeshiva. You know what he used to do every morning? He used to go into his 6-, 7-, 8-year-old son's room. It's young son's room. He used to take his son, who would be sitting in his pajamas and in his bathrobe, take him into the kitchen. And from, I think it was like 6 in the morning to 7 in the morning, when Shacharis began across the street in the yeshiva, Rav Bloch would sit with his young son and just talk to him about his day. What kind of day did you have yesterday? What kind of day are you planning today? Let me tell you a little bit about my day. And the memories that Rav Bloch's son has of those golden hours are really what shaped and forged his personality today as a successful leader in his own right. And I think that's a very important point. You have to figure out a way to prioritize it, because his son knew, nothing, as busy as my father is, and even though I'm not going to see him the rest of the day, nothing will get in the way of these early morning chats. And when we see that and see that our parents are looking to steal time for us, and we put that front and center, it's extremely, extremely important. Let me talk to you a little bit about the importance of time. Here's what the research shows. Some of you have probably heard me talk about this in the past. Every night a week that a parent has dinner with their child, there's correspondingly lower risk of drug abuse in that child. This is research done down the road by Dr. Califano at Columbia. So we found if you have dinner with your child one night a week, lower risk of drug abuse than no nights. Two nights, lower risk than one night. To the point that if you're having dinner with your child seven nights a week, the risk for drug abuse goes down to practically nil. And it's not the dinner. It's the time. It's the kamayim punim el punim. It's the hearts bouncing off each other like a reflection in water, as the Pasuk of Mishlei tells us. So there's that direct linear correlation between time spent with family members, and I even think effectiveness as a leader. You know, there's tremendous time pressure in this generation. And anybody here in any of your courses or in your studies have come across Bowling Alone, the book by Putnam from Harvard? It's a book that talks about changing trends in the United States. And one of the things that Dr. Putnam talks about is how time has become much more of a premium in this generation. People are just feeling much more pressured. That's amplified in our community where we have Bli Ayin Hara larger families, we have larger financial obligations, and it makes the challenge a little bit tougher. But in terms of priorities, this has to be, going into it, you have to keep your eye on the ball about this. The Kutzker says the following. He talks about a pasuk at the end of Tehillim that compares raising children to being an archer. It says at the end of Tehillim, Kechitzim b'yagivar kein b'nei hanurim. It compares being an archer to raising children. So Kutzker asks the obvious question. What's the connection between being an archer and educating your child? And he answers, just like an archer, the closer you hold the bow to your heart, the further and straighter the arrow goes, so too with raising children, the closer you hold them to your heart, the further and straighter the arrow goes. And that's why I'm opening, in terms of the opening salvo here, with the need for clarity of goals as you think about a life of leadership. And I'll talk about the values of leadership for most of my remaining time. But the most important thing is you have to put front and center what your priorities are. You have to understand that nothing comes ahead of the need to be there with your children, be there with your family, because if you can't be a good role model inside your home, it's hard to understand, you know, what gives you the ability to truly and effectively lead outside of the home. Okay? That we could talk about it, we could debate it, and you could disagree with me, and I may be wrong, but we'll talk about it. Okay? That's point one. Point two is just a sort of a subset of point one, and that's just that it's harder and harder nowadays to really get in touch with our goals. I've talked about this to you guys before, but the reality is that in an age sort of dominated by peace or hanefesh, by the what the Rabbeinu Bachya calls Hashem Yatzileni mi peace or hanefesh, save me from fragmentation of my soul. What he said 1,000 years ago is just as true today, if not more true today. In an age of multitasking, in an age of busyness, it's very hard to step back and really think for yourself, where do I want to be in 10 years? What are my goals? How do I want to spend my life? And now's the time in your lives that you should be doing this. That's why an important like a program like tonight is so important. Just so you'll know, everything's spoken in this room. It's only a handful of people will hear it in this room, but it'll really be heard on YU Torah Online. That's where you'll see many, many downloads. So we're not really, we're just talking, even though in this room there are, what, 500-600 people or so? But you'll see. It's the words go beyond. Kol Maaseh, Ayin Ro'ez and Shema'as Kol Maaseh B'Sefer Nechtavim. It'll go to a much wider audience, so we really have to behave ourselves. But I've quoted Michael Josephson to you guys before. He says, here's how you have to live your life. He says, you have to live your life, basically, it's the pasuk in Mishlei, Be'ein chazon yifara'am, without vision, there just can't be a nation. We sort of dwindle away. And he says, the head of the Center for Ethics in California, he says, the way you have to live your life is you have to imagine yourself as a fly on the wall at your funeral after 120 years. And you have to figure out what you want the Rav to say at your hesped. What are the three top things you want the Rav to say at your eulogy? And then he says, live life backwards. Okay? So, take-home message number one is that the all-encompassing importance of time and figuring out as you divvy up your time how much to give to family, how much to give to leadership, but the need to have clear vision. Because I'm sure that as you think about the three ways you want to be remembered, one of them may be leadership. But ultimately, my guess is ultimately at the top of the list, it's going to have to be about connection to, as Karma Cholonotata, the connection to your own vineyard. Okay, that's point two. And then the other points I wanted to make has to do with the positives. Because now that I've gotten the negatives out of the way, let me talk about the positives. The positives are what we read about in this last week's Parsha, the Bria Chatichon. The Bria Chatichon, as you all know, what was the center of the Mishkan? The center pillar of the Mishkan stood for Chesed. And what was the center pillar of the Mishkan made out of? Who knows? You know, what was it made out of? It's made out of but wood from where? The Medrash tells us. It was wood made from the tree that Avraham would sit under to be Machnas Orchem. Because it's a metaphor. It was floated down to where it could be put into the Mishkan. Because it's a metaphor for the pivotal component that Chesed and going out of your Dalet Amos has. And here's what the research shows, arguing against everything I've said until now. Here's the research. Generous parents make for generous children. Okay? Among those who say they saw their parents volunteer when they were children, well over half will volunteer as adults, compared to a far lower percentage of those who don't see it. Charitable parents are far more likely to have adult children who are also charitable. It's shipuitz, where Yaakov Kamenetsky would say, parents aren't mechanchem. They're not educators. They're mashbiyim, meaning, what's the word shipua? It's like a ramp. It's what ramps down. When kids see you being osek v'tzarchei tzibur, and you pull them into it, you can, first of all, be spending time with them by pulling them into it as your kids get old enough to do it. You want to make it, if possible, into the family bumper sticker. If the family bumper sticker is about leadership, you want to pull them into it as much as possible. That's what all the research shows. Okay, this is something that kids catch. You don't have to lecture to them about it. It's just by modeling. It's just by serving as a ramp. Okay, it's interesting. I'll just throw out one study and then maybe come to an end with the story. One study is a study that always makes me feel good. Okay, it's a study about a group of patients with multiple sclerosis. And they're all equally sick. They have equal level severity of MS. And they divide them into two, and they pair them off where people who have exactly the same level severity of MS. And they assign them two different tasks. One is assigned to be the nose. The one, your job, they're told, is to give. Your job is to take care of your partner. Call her up, see how she's doing. Offer to take her to the doctor. Take her shopping. Check in on her on a daily basis. And the other person's job is to be the makabel, is to accept. And they find in a very short period of time, you know what happens? The no-sane has two things happen. Their mood lifts and their depression levels go down. And the one who's giving rather than taking shows a significant improvement in their physical symptoms. The power of the not new is the palindrome, that when you give and you get back. And I can't emphasize enough what a gift it is that you'll be giving to your family as you're trying to find that balance by modeling it. The key, the devil's in the details. How do you model it in a way that you actually find that balance? That you have seichel and that you know when to say no, know when to delegate, know when it's appropriate for you to model for your kids, because you're really not just doing it for yourself, you're doing it for your children, grandchildren, and dore doros. So let me end with a story. You probably all heard my stories. How many of you heard, I know at least a few of you, how many of you heard my blind lady story? You didn't hear my blind lady story? Okay, so I'll end with this story. It's too good a story to pass up. and it looks like nobody knows it, which is good, because hopefully if you ever heard me say it, you were sleeping. Okay? So let me say this story, and it's one of my favorite Bria Hatichon stories, and then I'll give it over to Moshe. It goes like this. There's a Hasidish woman who's very active in the Jewish community in in New York. And she does all kinds of chesed. It's not a wealthy woman at all. And she once invited me, she often invited me to give talks to her Hasidish community about issues in the community. So let's say she called to talk like tonight for 8 o'clock. And like an idiot, I came at 8 o'clock because in Hasidic time, 8 o'clock means people start thinking about coming at about 10 o'clock, which means that I was alone with her in this big auditorium for about 2 hours. So we were schmoozing a little bit, you know? And what was happening as we schmoozed is she says, oh, let me tell you a story, a little story, and this is a perfect story. She says, I'm going to tell you a story about my 9-year-old daughter. Her 9-year-old daughter is extremely shy. Okay, extremely shy, and doesn't like to talk, keeps to herself, and my friend gets a new next-door neighbor. The apartment building next to her is a woman who had been blind most of her life. She's 63 years old, Mrs. Schwartz. She moves into the apartment building next to them, and my friend immediately, she lives a life of chesed, divides among her 12 children different tasks for the kids to do. So one's assigned to, go help Mrs. Schwartz take out the garbage. Other is assigned to help with minor cleaning tasks. Other is assigned to grocery shopping. And nightmare of nightmares, my friend goes to her 9-year-old daughter and says, your job is you have to go over to Mrs. Schwartz's house 2 nights a week and read to her. Okay, can you imagine a bigger nightmare for a 9-year-old girl? 63-year-old woman, you have to go 2 nights a week and read to her? She says, absolutely not, Mom, I'm not doing it. And my mother says, no, you don't have to want to do it. You just have to do it. But that's, I understand you don't want to do it. She's a good mother. And she pushed her. She forced her kids to do it. Of course, that became the high point of the little girl's week. She would go on a regular basis 2 nights a week to Mrs. Schwartz's house. A couple of months into the process, after her reading to Mrs. Schwartz, Mrs. Schwartz lets out a sigh, and she says, 2 more years. She tells the little girl, 2 more years, I'm going to see. The little girl says, no, you're not Mrs. Schwartz. You're blind. You're never going to see. She may have been shy, but she was also confident. Okay. And Mrs. Schwartz says, no. In 2 more years, I'm going to get a full Social Security check. My entitlements are going to come in a little bit bigger than they are now. And the doctor told me that since I was diagnosed with my blindness, they've developed new laser surgery that could correct my blindness. I can't afford it. But in 2 years, I'll start getting a little bit more money. I'll salt away my money, and I'll be able to save up enough to pay the doctor for the surgery. So look at what leadership does. Because the little girl, it wasn't a question to her what would come next. She didn't say a word to her mother. She didn't say a word to anybody in the whole community. She didn't ask her principal or her teacher. She goes to school the next day. She overcomes her shyness, remember? But not new as a palindrome. You give and you get back. She overcomes her shyness. She goes from class to class to class, and she whispers, there's a lady in my building who's blind, I need money. Goes to the next class. There's a lady in my building who's blind, I need money. She goes from class to class to class. She comes running to Mrs. Schwartz's apartment that night with 82 crumpled single dollar bills in an envelope. And she says, Mrs. Schwartz, I have the money. And she's holding the envelope. Mrs. Schwartz is blind. She doesn't know there's not even enough money. Maybe there's enough money in the envelope to pay for the TV as she's recuperating from surgery. But not for the surgery, not for the hospitalization, and certainly not for the years or the months of rehab till your brain learns it could see. She doesn't know. And the little girl takes the envelope, takes Mrs. Schwartz with her cane, goes to a frum ophthalmologist around the block. I once told over this story, there was a reporter from Mishpacha magazine in the audience, and he wrote down this story. And I got an email, both from Mrs. Schwartz and this ophthalmologist, telling me the story is 100% true, because it happened to them, okay? So what you're hearing is one of the few stories you'll hear from me that is actually true, okay? All the others I make up as I go along. So no, they're all true. It's just a little twist on the facts. But this one is without a twist on the facts. So ophthalmologist sees all his patients. He goes and he comes out after he sees his last patient and sees this strange scene of a little 9-year-old girl, no appointment, and a clearly blind older woman. Calls her in, gives her an exam, says, "Mrs. Schwartz, you don't have to be blind. I can fix this." He checks her into the hospital almost immediately. He does the surgery and restores her sight. And he arranges for the rehab. And the little girl never told her mother what happened, which is a strange thing. I have to ask this woman why. The daughter, she was shy. She don't like communicating so much. About a year later, Mrs. Schwartz is finally independent enough to go to the old neighborhood. What's the first thing you would do if you went to the old neighborhood? Try to find a little girl to thank her for restoring your sight. She goes to my friend's house. She tells my friend says, "Where have you been? We haven't seen you in a year. We didn't know what happened to you." And she tells her the stories. My friend is extremely, extremely grateful to the little to her daughter. Can you imagine how proud it is for Baal Schesed to see it going down with that shipua, the ramping down? But she realizes she has a debt to pay. Doesn't cost $83 to do that kind of surgery, hospitalization, and rehab. So she goes to the doctor. Okay, and the doctor tells me this is what happened. But she goes to the doctor. She waits till he sees all his patients. He calls her in, and she says, "I'm the mother of that little girl from last year. And I realize that my daughter incurred an incredible debt." She says, "I'm not a wealthy woman, but I honor my debts." She says, "I want you to put me on a payment plan. I'm going to give you a little bit every week. Maybe I'll raise a little bit of money from the community. It'll probably take the rest of my life till I can pay it off. But I want you to start the payment plan. Just tell me how much the check should be and where to send it." So the doctor laughs. He says, "Are you kidding? How often do you get to restore sight to a woman who's been blind the vast majority of her life?" He says, can I ask you a favor? He says, he takes out the tattered envelope with the 83 singles. And he says, "Can I keep this?" He says, "Ever since that day last year that your daughter came into my office, wherever I go, I carry this with me. And when I feel down in the dumps, I put my hand in my pocket, I feel those singles, and it restores my faith in humanity." That's the Bria Chatichon. That's leadership. That's what leadership does for your children, grandchildren, and Dori Doros. And that's the positive side. Okay, we're about to hear a little bit about the balance and a little bit more about the balance from somebody who's a true leader. But you're gonna introduce Moshe. Thank you, everybody.
Thank you for those inspiring words. Our next speaker is Mr. Moshe Bain. Mr. Bain is a partner at Ropes & Gray, LLP, and chair of their corporate restructuring department. He's been named one of the best lawyers in America, 2009 to 2012, and Chambers USA, America's leading lawyers for business, 2008 through 2011. He is also former national chairman of NCSY. He currently serves as chairman of the Board of Governors of the Orthodox Union. He is also a member of AJOP's executive board. Mr. Bain is a graduate of Johns Hopkins University and New York University's School of Law. He is also the proud husband of a former Stern graduate, Joanne. Mr. Bain.
So let me tell you the difference between what you heard from Dr. Pelkowitz and what you'll hear from me. What you heard from Dr. Pelkowitz is all MS, is all truth. It's based on empirical data, it's based on years of experience. Everything you're going to hear from me is opinion and is totally disposable at your whim. I'm going to just share with you my experiences, my perspectives, and as those of you who are more familiar with me may know, most times people don't agree with anything I say. So take it in that context, and that's the way I'm going to present it to you. Preliminarily, I will tell you that I find the topic of this evening's discussion fundamentally offensive. And it's an offense that I incur over and over again in not only Orthodox Jewish organizations, but Jewish organizations, and not only Jewish organizations, but organizations generally. And that's the terms that are used. The terms that were presented to you were professionalism, which I don't have a problem with. But then you have leadership and influence. And the implication is that everyone in this room has an enormous eagerness to be a leader and to be a person of influence. Frankly, that's antithetical, in my view, to Torah values. And certainly is antithetical to any aspiration that I had and continue to have. I have no interest whatsoever in being a leader. I don't even know what a leader means. I certainly have no interest in being a person of influence. What my interest has been for the last 30 years was to be someone who would help people. Someone who would help individuals, someone who would help the Jewish community. There's an enormous difference between aspiring to be a leader and aspiring to be an activist. And if you're looking for instructions on how to be a leader, a person of influence, I'm certainly not the guy for you. If you're interested in trying to figure out how to become an activist, someone whose actions could be a contribution to others and to the Jewish community, then you're a person who's speaking on the same wavelength as me. And there's an enormous difference. Because when a person aspires to be a leader, it's about them. It's about what role am I going to have, what my title is. You want to be a person of influence? Who says that your influence would be valuable? Who says that your hashkafas are valuable? Who says your opinions are oisgehalten, are proper? You're a young person. You think that you're going to be at the age of 40, 50, 60, someone whose influence is fundamentally going to be correct? That's very presumptuous. But your help, your assistance, that's enormously valuable, no matter who you are. Whether you turn into a leader, whether you turn into a person of influence, let fate take you down that road. But figure out early on, okay, am I going to be the kind of person who's going to live my life with the central creed of trying to help? And who you help and how you help and how expansive, maybe we'll talk about that if we have enough time a little bit. But that has to be the threshold issue. One of the common experiences that Dr. Pelkowitz and I have is over the last several months, we've both contributed to an online journal called Cloud Perspectives. And in the article that I published about 6 months ago, I identified two major, major problems that I feel are permeating the Jewish community right now, the Orthodox community right now. And they are really two sides of the coin of what you should be talking about in this kind of discussion. The second of the two is really what Dr. Pelkowitz referenced, and that is, in my observation, there has been, in essence, an elimination of the role of fatherhood in the Orthodox community. There has been a total abandonment of an intrinsic, intertwined relationship between fathers and children, particularly as sons reach high school and beyond. It's almost been an abdication of the influence and intimacy of fatherhood. I mean, one of the examples that I give to people is when you walk into a shul on a Friday night, look to see if the sons are sitting next to their fathers. And at least 50% of the time, you'll find the kids sitting in the back row among each other, not next to their father. And you say, well, why is that the case? And I say, well, wait till after shul and see who the father is walking home with. And when the father is walking home with his friends talking, he's telling his friends and he's telling his son, I'd rather schmooze with my friends than schmooze with my son. And of course, then the son says, well, if I'm not my father's best friend, then I'm going to sit with my best friend. The second part of the article that I wrote, which is really what I want to talk about, is the isolationist culture that the Orthodox community has assumed over the last 40, 50 years in America. But let me introduce that with a reference to a very well-known quote. And it's quoted, I've heard as I was growing up, in the name of Musar Rebbes, and then I heard it once in the name of Mao Zedong, and then once I heard it in the name of Confucius. So I looked it up online this afternoon before coming here, and I saw that it's most popularly attributed to a 12th century unnamed monk. But it's a statement that I would be shocked if you never heard. I heard it at least 40 times when I was growing up, and you'll see in a minute why. The statement goes the following, and in fact, you know, very interesting, when my daughter was engaged to my son-in-law, and I was talking to him about his aspirations in life, he said, you know, I have this aspiration and this aspiration, but you know, throughout my education, this is what my Rebbeim told me, and they quoted this following monk attributed statement, and that was the famous line, "When I was a young man, I wanted to change the world. And then when I got a little older, I found that I couldn't change the world, so I wanted to change my nation. And when I couldn't do that, I wanted to change my town. And when I couldn't do that, I wanted to change my family. And now that I'm an old man, I'm realizing all I could do is change myself." And that's a very profound statement to make. And it's told to people who are young, who are idealistic, who want to change the world. And I told my son-in-law, I said, no, those people who were trying to caution you against aspirations and ideals didn't understand what that statement is intended to convey. They think the intent is to tell the 18, 20, 22-year-old, don't try to change the world, just worry about yourself. That's not the way I interpret that story. The way I interpret that story is, you want to be the kind of person who's going to want to change yourself when you're an old man? Then you better damn well be an 18-year-old who wants to change the world. If at your stage in life, you're not sitting here saying, I could change the world, you're never going to want to change yourself. You're not going to want to change your family, your town, your nation. You're not going to change anything. If at this point in life, when you're sitting in yeshiva, looking out at the needs of Klal Yisrael and the needs of the world, and you're saying, I'm not going to be one who's going to be involved in trying to change the world, you're dead. You're brain dead. You're certainly spiritually dead. It's over. Go home. What are you doing? It's over. You have to have it in your gut. I'm going to change the world. Now, you're going to deal with realities as time goes on, of course. But at least you've got to start with the premise. This is where I want to go. Now, if you're saying, okay, my reason I'm here tonight is I want to learn how to balance being a successful, financially rewarded professional and helping Klal Yisrael. I got to tell you, you're not going to do it. It ain't going to happen. It ain't going to happen. You know why? Because life is tough. And making money is incredibly difficult. Incredibly difficult. And much more difficult now than it ever was. I get resumes on a weekly basis from top-tier graduates of law schools looking for jobs who can't find jobs. It's terrible out there. And in any field, across the board, it's much more challenging to make a living today than it was when I was starting out. And not only is it more difficult to make a living, the amount of money you need just to make ends meet as an Orthodox family is daunting. Right? So it's going to be very, very demanding on your time to just take care of your family. And then, as Dr. Pelkowitz so eloquently told us, you got to worry about your family even beyond your job. You got to spend time with your wife. You got to spend time with your children. And don't think for a minute it's just your children. It's your wife as well. It takes a lot of time. Now, I think sometimes in my office, I'm looking at the people who work for me. I had a firm woman came to me about 3 years ago. She had been clerking for a judge, and she sent her resume to be interviewed. I didn't know she was Orthodox at the time. She came, she showed up with a shaitel, and I see she's an Orthodox woman, 26, 27-year-old woman, three children, and she's describing what she wants to do. And I told her, look, you know, if you really want to work here, then I'll come have you come back and meet more of my partners, and you know, you certainly have the credentials. But do you understand what it means to work in a law firm like this? I mean, people who work in my office are expected to be available 24/7. If you're Orthodox, okay, it'll be 24/6. But you're going to be here all night many, many times. When I was a young associate, I very often came back to work after Shabbos was over. Certainly Sundays was normative. I mean, do you understand how demanding it is? And she said, okay, let me think. I didn't realize it. And I said, call friends, call people. That's the way it is. It's incredibly demanding. And I often say to myself, well, how does a firm person do it? Meaning, if everybody else is working around the clock and you're taking off 26, 27 hours a week for Shabbos, and then you have to daven three times a day, and you got to learn. I mean, you can't plan a life in a profession and not learn at least an hour a day. Come on. I mean, you're B'nai Torah here. You have to learn Torah. And you want to have a family, and you want to take care of your marriage. How are you possible even to make it as a professional, never mind want to change the world as well? So forget about it. Unless you start off with a completely different mindset. I'll tell you how my mindset worked. I'll tell you a very, very personal story. I was part of a chevra, a group of guys in yeshiva, who were very idealistic. We wanted to change the world. We did incredible things very young in terms of planning things we wanted to do. We got together. We had retreats. We were 19, 20, 21. We wanted to change the world. Now, of the group of eight of us, Six of the group were incredible Talmidei Chachamim, very, very serious guys, would sit and learn 14, 15 hours a day, and then there were me and one other guy, and we were not in that category. What are you going to do? And near the end of my yeshiva tenure, I was planning to go to law school. I was already, you know, my time was coming close to the end of the year to leave to go to law school. And one of the Rosh Yeshiva called me into his office and said, you know, we were going through the students, and your name came up, and someone noted, as we all knew, that you were leaving to law school, and we think that's a mistake. It's a mistake. We think you should go into the rabbinate. You'd be a great rabbi, and you have a relationship with this particular rabbi with whom I still have a close relationship. You'll go, you'll do shimush with him for a few years, then you'll go into the rabbinate. And I said to this Rosh Yeshiva, I said, you know, I've been here in yeshiva for 8 years, and I've learned a lot in yeshiva during my 8 years. One of the things you taught me is that there are two types of rabbis. You taught me there's a type of rabbi who I should respect, and then there's another kind of rabbi you taught me not to respect so much. But when you tell me to be a rabbi, you're thinking I'll be the kind of rabbi who you taught me not to respect. No one was hoping I would paskin shilas, okay? No one wanted me to do that kind of stuff. But you also taught me there are two types of balabatim, and I think I could be the kind of balabas you taught me to respect. So I'd rather be a balabas that I'd respect than a Rav who I wouldn't respect. And that story today is in spades. It's in spades because what Klal Yisrael needs has changed dramatically in 30 years since I was in yeshiva. When I was a yeshiva bachur, there was an enormous vacuum in American Jewry for rabbis, for teachers, for principals. It's not the case anymore. Go to Kollel Elyon and find out how many guys have been looking for a job for years. Go to Lakewood and there are 10 times more who have been looking. And the same is true in Eretz Yisrael, and the same is true in 5 other yeshivas around the country. There is no longer a vacuum for basic needs in satisfying Jewish community professionals. But you know what there is a need for? There is an enormous need for balabatim who are going to be committed to Klal Yisrael. Now, I'm not telling you shouldn't go into Rabbanus if that's where your heart is leading you, or to Chinuch if that's where you want to go. I'm just suggesting to you, if you look at the spectrum of the needs of Klal Yisrael, the biggest number one need is for askanim, is for people who are going to commit themselves to helping the Jewish community. But the only way it's going to work, in light of the demands that will be on your time at work, and in light of the amount of time it's going to take care of your family, the only way it's going to work is if your self-image is, this is who I am. And everything else I'm doing in my job is merely to facilitate my ability to help Klal Yisrael. If you're looking at it as, I'm going to go become a doctor, I'm going to go become a businessman, I'm going to become an architect, whatever it is, and I'll help Klal Yisrael, ain't going to happen. Because realistically, it's not going to be available to you. It's just not going to be. But if you look at yourself, my role in the world is to be an askan, is to be someone who's going to help individuals or communities or the nation, whatever your role turns out to be. And if anybody thinks that they have any idea what their role is until they're 40, 50, you're just working yourself up to get to that point where you're a big enough person to figure out what your role is. The question is what your self-image is, and that is something you've got to start with now. Who am I? What role do I want to play? What skills do I need? What hashkafas do I need? I always tell my kids and other people who spend time with us, in today's world, unless you know how to learn well, you don't have a chance of being a Jewish community activist. It's the equivalent of being illiterate. You have to sit in yeshiva and learn Torah. So when you want to be a person who plays a role in the community, you're a player. You're literate. You know how to learn a piece of Gemara. You know how to tell a shir. You know how to say a Dvar Torah. You know, your time here is not just preparing yourself for your career. It's giving you the nuts and bolts to be a player. Now, let me just conclude, and we'll hopefully have some time for discussion, with two yesodos that I want to share with you. And as I said before, everything I'm saying is just my opinion. I'm sure there are many, many people who will refute and disagree vehemently with much of what I'm telling you. I just want to share with you two yesodos that are off topic in a certain sense, but if the goal here of tonight is, okay, what's the nuts and bolts of what you need to know, I want to share with you two concepts outside of the general theme of encouragement that I'd like to convey. And they're two life experience realizations I've reached during the course of my attempt to try to evolve into someone who would be a helpful personality in the community. The first one is the enormous value of inconsistency. Okay? What do I mean by that? You know, when I was your age, I remember that I viewed inconsistency and hypocrisy as synonymous. And certainly, hypocrisy was the most offensive violation that a young person views in another person. Don't be a hypocrite. I mean, that was a vehement accusation. You could hardly insult someone more dramatically than calling them a hypocrite. And that attitude, that inconsistency and hypocrisy were identical, was an enormous limitation on my life. Because there were so many roles that I was asked to play, both publicly as well as privately, by myself, that I would say, who am I? I do this wrong, and I do that wrong, and I'm not that big of a Talmid Chacham, and I don't learn well enough, and my brachas are lousy, and I miss minyan, and I do all these things wrong. Who am I? And then one year, about 10 years ago, I said, you know what, for a year, it was Erev Yom Kippur. I'll never forget it. Erev Yom Kippur, I said, you know what, let's try for a year to embrace inconsistency. And tell myself, and this is what I did, I said, look, what I'm going to try to do is eliminate using my flaws as an excuse not to strive for growth in other areas. And it changed who I was. I still have the flaws. But did they even get worse? And maybe they even got a little better. But I was able then to strive for things that until then I viewed as being hypocritical. They weren't hypocritical. They were merely inconsistent. That's point number one. And if you don't appreciate what I'm saying, maybe we could talk about it further, because I think it's an important lesson for how to train yourself to grow. The second is even more important. In my house, I was brought up, and I developed an environment in my house, both for my children as well as those who hang around a little bit, of enormous ambition. Enormous ambition. Ambition financially, ambition professionally, an ambition in Torah, an ambition in Ruchnius, an ambition in affecting clients. Tremendous ambition. An ambition, I think, is a prerequisite to success. I'll tell you just as an aside, my primary Rebbe in life was Rabbi Yaakov Weinberg, Zatzal, Rosh Yeshiva Neri Yisrael. And on a number of occasions, he emphasized to me what he viewed as a total miscomprehension of the famous Mishnah in Pirkei Avos, Eizo HaAshir HaSameh B'Chelko. Right? And everybody says, Eizo HaAshir HaSameh B'Chelko, what does that mean? It means that who's a wealthy person? Someone who's satisfied with their lot. It says people totally misunderstand that. They think that the message of that Mishnah is that you shouldn't be ambitious. You should be happy with what you have. What's the problem? Don't be ambitious. He goes, that's ludicrous. That's not what it means at all. Of course you should want more. Well, you shouldn't go to your boss for a raise because you're violating the Mishnah. Of course you should want more. In fact, a person who's not ambitious in their profession, in their finances, it impacts their entire personality. People are holistic beings. People who become apathetic in one area of life become lackadaisical in their ruchnius as well. You have to train your personality to be ambitious in every area. And if you're going to go into a field, be the best you could be. And then when you daven, you'll try to do it the best you could do it. And when you learn, you'll try to do it the best. And when you're a father and a husband, you'll try to do it the best. You should try to excel. He says, what does a Mishnah mean? The Mishnah means that there are two types of relationships to ambition. One is, I want something. And one is, I need something. And we meet many, many people who have goals and they become needs. And failure to achieve those goals means in their hearts and their minds that they're failed. That they failed. They're failures. Because they had a need that wasn't met. You could want things. Just don't make your wealth aspiration a need. Don't make it a must-have. Make it, I'm going to work hard. I'm going to try to go into business or whatever field you're going to go into and try to be successful. But don't define yourself by it. Don't make it a need. That was just an aside. My point that I wanted to make, however, is that if you want to assume a life of aspiration, of goals, of going for the big time, there's a basic yesod you need to embed into your brain, make it part of your psyche, and it's one of the most elusive goals. The term I used, and I continue to use, is the glory of failure. The glory of failure. I have encountered through the last couple of decades, one after another, people who are embellished in enormous either scandal, financial scandal, or they would do inappropriate behavior with regard to an organization. They may have a Jewish institution and do improper things with the government. And one after another, inappropriate behaviors that either destroy them or they get away with it. It's irrelevant. And I often say, well, did they start out that way? Were they just crooked people when they were in yeshiva? Did they think they were going to be crooked people, whether they are businessmen who are stealing from others or whether they are running a yeshiva and stealing from the government? Did they start out that way? And I concluded, no, they didn't. But what happens is when you're ambitious, and ambition is a prerequisite to success in my view, but when you're ambitious, over time what happens is that that ambition becomes so intertwined with your self-image that when you're confronted with a challenge, whether it be in your office or your beis hamedrash, to do something improper or fail, you can't tolerate failing. If you're running a factory and you have to rely on your income tax statement and have enough cash flow to keep the factory alive, you have no choice but to lie, because your life, your image, is the owner of that factory. If you're a Rosh Yeshiva that has 200 Talmidim and you're going to run out of money and have to close it down, the only way you can keep it open is to steal from the government, I'm a Rosh Yeshiva. This is who I am. I can't close it down. You have to have in your heart of hearts the glory of failure. And the glory of failure tells you that when you have to close your yeshiva, or you have to declare bankruptcy, or you have to tell your family, we need to move to an apartment and sell our house because I refuse to do something wrong and this is just the fate that we've encountered financially, that is the ultimate glory in life. And if you want to introduce ambition to your life, if you want to make that part of who you are, and you want to become a significant human being, you have to simultaneously get into your gut of guts that the most kosher that you could be is to accept failure because the alternative would be inappropriate. If you take all of these pieces together, look, you guys know it. You guys are it. I mean, look around the world today. There's no one out there. You guys are the only ones that are going to carry the load for Klal Yisrael over the next 50 years. You better step up to the plate and do it. But it's going to take attitude. It's going to take ambition. It's going to take guts, but it's worth it, because that's who you become. Thank you very much.
I don't know about you guys, but I feel very fortunate for having come tonight. We're now going to open up the floor for questions. You could ask questions generally, or you could address them to a specific member of our panel. Elkanon, yes.
I guess this is a question speakers. So when we talk about leadership or help or whatever it is, somebody mentioned that a lot of positions and like all the educational and rabbinic positions are pretty much full and there's a lot out there. So do you think that that's true also in terms of when a person decides to initiate any role in the community? Do you think that that's something that they should be doing through all these organizations? That's something they should be taking their own initiative? It's something they should just look out for the blind person, or just be looking at. How do you think that should play in today's day and age, where there are so many organizations and causes going here?
Well, let me introduce to you two threshold questions that you're going to have to grapple with if you want to be a Jewish activist. And we'll partially address the question, partially I'll go a little beyond the question. I remember when I was in my early 20s and I was grappling with that exact type of question, I realized that there were four categories of Jewish activists divided into two overlapping questions. The first question is, do you want to be a entrepreneur or do you want to be a corporate guy? You know, let's say, I don't know how many of you have any business ambition, but when you deal with a guy who's graduating Stanford MBA or another school's MBA and they want to become a billionaire, they have a fundamental choice. Do I want to become an entrepreneur? Do I want to start a business with an idea in my garage? Or do I want to go work for Google or go work for Yahoo or go work for IBM or Procter & Gamble, whatever it is, and try to work my way up the system and become the CEO? And either route could make you fabulously wealthy and either route could devastate you financially, depending on who you are and how successful you turn out to be. But you have to decide, well, what fits me? What fits my personality? What fits my skill set? And based on that self-analysis, you're going to decide, okay, am I going to become an entrepreneur, or am I going to try to make it in corporate America? The same is true in Clawer. You have to decide, do I want to become a community entrepreneur, coming up with ideas, putting together small groups of people to address particular needs and see where it goes? Or do I want to join into corporate Klal Yisrael? Do I want to join the larger organizations? There is no right or wrong answer to that. It's who you are. What is going to most likely tap into your skill set and your character and personality? The second overlapping issue, and this is even more unusual to be talking about, certainly in a yeshiva environment, but I'm a big fan of analyzing it this way, and that is, you want to be anti-establishment or you want to be establishment? Do you want to be against the system or do you want to be in favor of the system? And I got to tell you, from my perspective, I became an establishment guy 30 years ago. I don't know if I made the right decision. A lot of days I said, boy, I wish I was an anti-establishment guy because I really don't like the establishment. And I'm so invested in it, it's terrible. But in either way, whether you want to be an entrepreneur or you want to be a corporate Klal Yisrael guy, you have to make those two decisions. What approach do you take? And do you want to be anti or pro? And I can give you dozens of examples of anti-establishment guys who are incredibly effective and vice versa as well. So I don't think there's a right answer to your question. I think you have to decide who you are. And frankly, most of our discussion tonight, I would suggest Dr. Pelkowitz's is certainly mine, the fundamental threshold question you've got to deal with is, who are you? Who am I? What are my skills? What are my propensities? What do I have to contribute to Klal Yisrael? And once you figure that out, then you can start talking about what route to take. The biggest challenge that I think a young person has when they want to plan a life of commitment to Klal Yisrael, the biggest challenge is figure out, who are you? And frankly, you know, and I don't know the YU environment well enough. I do know that in the rest of the yeshiva world, it's a major crisis right now. And that is, the only way to really get to know who you are is with the help of somebody else. Historically, that's been a Rebbe. Today, there's an enormous paucity of a Rebbe-Talmud relationship in the Haredi yeshiva world. I don't know how, in YU, you have many more Rebbeim than in a typical yeshiva on a ratio basis. So maybe your guys are able to take advantage of that. But I would encourage you very, very strenuously, whether it be a rabbi type or not a rabbi type, to find someone to become your Rebbe. And the Rebbe's role will be to help you learn who you are and be an objective standard to help you figure out, okay, what role should I be playing? Because unless you figure that out, you're going to waste a lot of time going down the wrong road.
As I was hearing the wonderful talk that we just heard, what's running through my mind is the Maharal relevant to Pesach. He talks about, obvious question, why is matzah called lechem only, okay? And how can you have the symbol for cheros be poverty? It makes no sense. And he says, and then he compares that to lechem ashir of egg matzah. So here's what he says. It's unbelievably brilliant psychologically in terms of what you were just saying. He says, ani ein lo ela atzma. He says, a poor person only has himself. Poor person, basically, it's just him and the world. It's just you and the world. He says, lechem ashira, in contrast, is it's dependent. It's dependent on the fruit juice, dependent on the eggs, it's dependent on other stuff. And he goes on to say, because the ultimate cheros is the cheros of a person who has nothing other than himself to fall back on. And the problem is that very often we get pulled into what psychologists call impression management. We're more worried about the impressions we make on others. We're much more like egg matzah than lechem omi. And the goal is once you discover who you are, then dating falls into place. Then career choice may start to fall into place. It's taking much longer for it to happen there. With the Odyssey years and the changes in emerging adulthood, the whole process has become elongated by as much as 10 years. And that's normal. That's normal now. It's taking much longer for people to figure out where they're going because of changes out there in the world and in the job market and in the dating market. But the bottom line is, I can't agree more than with what Moshe was saying, that it's a matter of goals. Your goal has to be to help. Your goal has to be to change. But your goal has to be to do whatever is the best fit for you. So you have to go into places without any agenda. It's just with an agenda to help. And then it'll either pull you into a very meaningful experience, and this meaningful experience, then you probably will become play a very important leadership role, or it won't be a good match. Very often I see people getting pulled into organizations that are not a good match for them. It has to be a shidduch. But the key to the shidduch, I think, is it has to be about developing your own uniqueness. And that, I think that's the key. So just think of that maral. Okay, the maral says it all. You know?
What are some good examples of anti-establishment figures for initiatives that you see?
Before your cognitive stage in life, and maybe even before you were born, there were two personalities in American Orthodoxy that had, in my view, some of the most profound impact on Klal Yisrael, on the way we think and the way we behave. Both of these individuals were viewed as totally chutz l'machna, totally anti-establishment. Both of these individuals were spurned by the organizational world as well as by the rabbinic leadership world. And both of these individuals changed the way the establishment behaved. And who are these two individuals? One was Meir Kahana, and one was Shlomo Carlebach. There is no one who davens the same as they would if Shlomo Carlebach didn't exist. The way we look at the Jewish pride and Jewish relationships with the non-Jewish world was fundamentally impacted by Meir Kahana. No one in the establishment embraced either view in its totality. Anti-establishment doesn't mean that you take over the establishment. Anti-establishment is a technique to change the needle, to move the needle. And those were two examples that I would suggest are enormous evidence of being outside of the system, but changing the system. So, and there are probably others that you could evidence. I mean, I would suggest, and after we get on tape, I can give you other examples.
Are there fewer of them today than there were?
There are fewer of anybody today.
But you know what? You may not know it. You know, I knew, I'm sure you knew, I knew Shlomo Carlebach. Mm-hmm. I mean, not well, but I was exposed to him a lot repeatedly. He used to, you know, there were different kinds of connections. And I also was exposed to Meir Kahana, who started Moralton, which is the neighboring mm-hmm. community where I grew up. They were both, during much of their lifetime, viewed as Meshuggahs, and they were not viewed as mainstream, and nobody really viewed them in the same way that they're viewed today. So I think that's a part of it.
Yeah.
You know, when you look back on it and you see how transformative Shlomo Carlebach was, I remember, if I could just share with you a memory, I live in Great Neck, I got to get in Israel with Great Neck. So there was a guy in our shul who was one of the founders of transplant surgery for the world, a world-renowned guy, and he helped save Shlomo Carlebach's life. They were very, very close. A fun guy, a very world-renowned surgeon, Dr. Rappaport, some of you may know some of his children. And because of their connection, Shlomo Carlebach used to come to our shul and daven sometimes for the Amud or run a shel shudis and do a Havdalah. It was viewed by most of the shul as a nightmare. I look back on it now. I remember, you know, running out. I feel like I was such an idiot back then. Running out of Shal Shudas to have a breakaway minion, because we knew if we stayed with Shlomo Carlebach, we wouldn't be getting home till 2-3 hours after Shabbos. And I remember really resenting him and not appreciating him. And now I look back on that. And similar stories with Meir Kahana. You look back on it, at the time, it's often that way. I had Rav Palm as my Rebbe. He was a very establishment guy, but he was my Rebbe for 4 or 5 years. Back then, nobody viewed him. Back then, he had a master's in math. Back then, he was a regular guy. There's a shift in the way people are viewed much later, and we have to mm-hmm. keep that in mind. But I think the commonality of those two individuals mm-hmm. is they had a unique voice, And they really epitomize the ani ein lo ela atzmo of the Maharal I was talking about. They epitomize not really caring very much what others thought. And I remember both of them, so I remember most about them. It's just not caring. You know, they had their eye on the ball in terms of what they thought they were bringing, and that's what they did. And it was about giving. It wasn't about narcissism in either case, I don't think. You know.
Part of the assumptions that are in this question. But it seems that having money can enable someone to be, let's say, having a lot of money to be blunt, can enable a person to be more of an activist. Both A, in that you can be active in giving, and that can be a first step in getting involved in an organization. You can start an organization if you have money, and a lot starts with money. I imagine a certain amount of respect comes from having money, and people will just see you as a successful person and value what you have to say because you've proven it in the business world. So to what extent should that be sought after because it would enable a person to be a greater activist? Or should a person, and it's hard to plan that I want to make X amount of money, but speaking generally, to what extent should that be sought after being successful in the business world because that would enable a person to be a better activist and do more good? And to what extent should a person shy away from that because it could suck a person into getting too involved? It could, and just you'll have more time to be involved in the organization, more time for your family if you don't seek, you know, being that super professional in the business world. Have more time to give to those priorities if you did not go the extra mile in the business world. So, which, you know, how does one kind of think about that?
That's the best for you. You're the law firm partner. I'm a professor.
But I think that comment is really the answer I was intending to give. When I was your age, my aspiration was to become fabulously wealthy and have an enormous impact on Klal Yisrael through that avenue. What I learned over the subsequent 30 years is the amount of money it takes for money to have an impact in today's world is so enormous as to be unrealistic. There are people who become fabulously wealthy, and we're talking about, you know, hundreds of millions of billions of dollars. The firm community, Baruch Hashem, has people of that magnitude. I don't believe that you could aspire to achieve that b'derech hateva. It may happen, maybe it'll happen to you, but it's not a realistic career plan. It's not. Certainly if you want to be honest. If you want to be an Ish Yashar, it may happen, but you can't, it's not b'derech. The teva of the business world does not lead someone to make that enormous amount of wealth. And in today's world, if you want your wealth to have the impact on Klal Yisrael, it has to be enormous. What I discovered is it's not money that makes people effective. It's success. People who are successful in whatever they're doing are respected. And the success could be in law, it could be in business, it could be in psychology. And there could be an enormous difference in how that success translates into income. That's not the point. Unless you have $100 million to start a national, you know, trend in something, having an extra $10,000, $50,000, $100,000 is not going to do much for Klal Yisrael. Anything today is so expensive, your role has to be demanding and justifying people supporting your dreams and playing a role in raising the money. So what I would suggest to you is that don't look at money as being the currency that effectuates effective activists. But I would acknowledge that success in whatever field you happen to choose will make a difference. And the degree of dignity and degree of deference that you'll enjoy will be dependent on your success in your respective field. So when you're worried about getting drawn into all of the seductiveness of money, which is a real seductive power and very distracting and very dangerous for your family and for yourself, you may say, okay, because of these concerns, I don't think I can handle it. I don't want to have to try to figure out whether I can handle it. Let me go into another field that will make enough of a parnasa to support my family, but it won't be my money that will have the impact.
I'm going to use my stature in whatever field I choose as the platform to go to the community and try to affect the help I intend to affect.
I'm learning, I think, more than anybody.
Right here in the second row. Mr. Bain spoke about how we're seeing a regression in the role of fatherhood in the Jewish community, and it seems that children's hashkafas and their chaim is coming mostly from their chinuch, their peers, their rebbeim. So, that being the reality, do you think, and this is certainly addressed to both of you, is the typical yeshiva system that we're used to right now, in terms of curriculum, in terms of what we're taught, in terms of the messages that rebbeim send, are we on track to build future Aspanim and leaders, or do certain things maybe need to be changed a little in both aspects to be more successful?
Yeah, it's a good question. I mean, the question is let's look at the take-home messages that we heard from Mr. Bain, and maybe from what I said also. So the take-home messages have to do with authenticity, with following your voice, have to do with wanting to help, wanting to get past yourself, chesed, et cetera, et cetera. So the real question you're asking is, to what extent does our current yeshiva system enable that kind of atmosphere? To what extent does our current educational system build on a child's uniqueness and build on their ability to find their own voice? And I think it probably depends. There's some schools that are terrific at it. I think for the most part, it's tough. I think for the most part, many schools are doing a pretty poor job of it. You know, so the more modern schools maybe keep their eye on the ball. What does it take to be viewed as a successful head of a modern Orthodox high school? It's how many kids you get into the top universities, and you know, what's the mean SAT score? You know, what's the percentage of kids that are accepted into Ivies, etc. That doesn't make for uniqueness. If anything, that's the affluenza I've often talked to you guys about, where we see triple the rate of depression and anxiety and alcohol abuse in affluent adolescents who live in communities that don't feed their uniqueness. So I think that are there some schools that are terrific at it, are terrific at not having, you know, one mold and allowing kids to break out of the mold? Yes. But is that the default setting for the average school? I'm not so sure. In the more yeshivish place, I think that the problem there, as Moshe, I think, could amplify better than I can, is that it becomes, it's very hard to find your uniqueness if you're not a superstar Gemara person. And what if your uniqueness is in leadership skills, or your uniqueness is in some other completely different area and not necessarily in in-depth learning, then it's a very tough and narrow world. You know, it becomes a world with very little wiggle space, very little wiggle room. And it doesn't take much to be able to feel yourself to be a failure in that world, which squelches the core active ingredient of Aniyem Lo El Atzma. So I think we have to do a better job of expanding our definition of success, expanding our definition of constructive failure. Many of you have heard me talk about the neurosurgeon study that I like to quote, you know, where they look at the top 1% of neurosurgeons in the country and the bottom 1%, and the key differentiator of that elite group is not manual dexterity or residency program, it's how the neurosurgeons handle their failure. Top 1% embrace their failure from setback to feedback. And we have to figure out a way to make our schools reflect a similar kind of ethic.
Mr. Bain, you were saying before that when you were in yeshiva, Rosh Shiva said to respect these kinds of rabbis, this is the men respect these kinds of rabbis.
On tape?
No, let me put it this way. I would have been, I really believe this, the top conservative rabbi in the country. I mean, I had a lot of skills that a rabbi needs, but no one fashioned me as a Talmudic scholar or a halachic scholar. And what I was presented during my yeshiva tenure was, and I think, frankly, I still embrace that view, that to be a successful Rav, you need to have the entire gamut. Not only human skills and human interrelationship skills and sympathetic tendencies and the like, but you also need to know how to pass a shiloh. And that wasn't my strength.